Get rolling on the Wintrust Business Lunch, produced by Pete Zimmerman. Hi, it's Sean Williams here till 1 o'clock. Anna DeBlantis and Pete will entertain and inform you after 1 o'clock, and we'll do our best efforts here as well. On the Wintrust Business Lunch, we start today with Mark Hamrick. He's from the Washington Bureau, the chief and senior economic analyst at Bankrate. The website is bankrate.com. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you, John. Thanks for having me.
I'll ask you the same question I asked Congressman LaHood a few moments ago. What's the best and worst of this stimulus package?
The worst is the timing, because it's been so long in coming, but better late than never. The best is that it's happening, and that I think there's something for many in this. You know, there's everything from the extension of unemployment benefits, the $600 stimulus checks, the higher level of unemployment compensation, the extension of the moratorium on evictions, but also some things that might not catch the eye, including the extra funding for the payroll protection program, as well as some money for live theaters and movie theaters. So, you know, there are many parts of our economy that are hurting right now. It, to me, has been inexcusable that it's taken this long for them to get this bipartisan legislation through, but it does appear that it will be happening, and so I guess we'll count that as a Christmas miracle.
Yeah, I hate to, I just have to state the obvious, I think. I don't see anything in here so complicated or that we haven't talked about 10 times already, that maybe it won't be $1,200, maybe it'll be $600, maybe it won't be $600, maybe it'll be $300 on the supplement. Maybe you ought to extend money to live venues because they could use help. There's nothing mysterious about this. Why did it take them so long?
Well, you think about how they judge Olympic gymnastics, the degree of difficulty in execution, right? And probably on both of these, you wouldn't make it onto the next round of competition. So I think ultimately it was that the economic data was getting to the point of potentially embarrassing those who are otherwise sometimes shameless. And the fact that we now have had two monthly declines in retail sales data, albeit the October decline, the slightest of misses, but that November miss is pretty big, and the ongoing numbers with the weekly jobless claims are horrific to the extent that you have well over a million people when you combine the two programs there. And this is now week 40 of the downturn. So, you know, I think that we were generally well served by what members of both parties and both chambers did with the CARES Act, and unfortunately it took something like 270 days for them to come to bipartisan agreement, assuming that it actually does happen here, which it does. And the other part is, as you know, John, it looks like both sides, meaning Republicans on one side and Democrats on the other, relented on key aspects of this that they'd really been pressing for, the Dems on state and local government funding and the business side on the Republicans with concern about putting liability protections in there. So that seemed to get us over the hump, along with a sort of a last-minute snag with a rather complicated aspect of trying to make sure the Federal Reserve does what the members of Congress want it to do.
Yeah. But it makes it sound like you are saying that while the amount of aid coming out is shrinking, it's less than it was last time, the need for aid is expanding right now. Is that a fair assessment?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, my friend Heather Long, who works at the Washington Post, has done great work about the additional millions of people who have slid into poverty during this time. We know that as of the last unemployment report, essentially nearly 11 million Americans were unemployed, and that's a somewhat strict definition of unemployment. And we know that we're getting these, you know, essentially a million a week who are filing for unemployment benefits, and we know that millions are at risk of being thrown out of their apartments or ultimately have been foreclosed upon with their mortgages. So there's a lot of different ways to measure the financial strain. Our own Bankrate survey finding that half of all households had suffered a decline in income this year, and of those, half think that it'll take 6 months or longer to get back to where they were before. 6% thought they would never get back.
I was a little disappointed in the extension of rent forgiveness. I don't mean forbearance, but they can't kick renters out. but they've only extended that to the 1st of February, as I see it. Maybe, at least I think that's the way I read that. Or maybe it was that there would be rent relief, but whatever it was, it only goes to the end of January.
Well, I think the thought there is let's get another administration in and see what they're going to do. I think that once President-elect Biden takes the oath of office, I have no doubt that there's basically a checklist of things that they're going to attend to, whether it's through executive order or, depending on their margin in the Senate, through legislation. And the CDC is, of all places, the entity that puts the eviction moratorium in place, so there's nothing to prevent the CDC from doing that again either.
Mm. Okay, well, we'll continue to follow that. Like you said, something's better than nothing, and we did get something. It's nice to talk to Mark Hamrick, Washington Bureau Chief and Senior Economic Analyst at Bankrate.com. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, John. Happy holidays.
Likewise to you, too. You are listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on WGN Radio. Bruce Faber is the owner of EHS Hospitality, Illinois, and Wisconsin branches. You can visit EHSHospitality.com. Bruce, welcome back to WGN Radio. How are you today?
Doing great, John. Great to be back.
Are you optimistic about this stimulus package? There was money carved out for restaurant businesses and venues, things like that.
The timing couldn't be better. Just like the last speaker said, a little late, but at least it's here. It's a Christmas gift, and it's going to help a lot of restaurants, entertainment venues, and just so many hospitality operations stay alive.
How will that work? I mean, at the ground level, the businesses will apply for these grants or loans and then presumably pass that along to their employees?
Well, there's two ways. One, the businesses can apply and certainly should apply to get those loans, especially to take them through the cold winter season. From an employee standpoint, they can still apply for unemployment because there's still so many employees out there from the hospitality industry that are not working because the restaurants are closed or minimal staffing, or just doing, you know, delivery and takeout.
Right. So if I run a club or a restaurant in Chicago, say, or the surrounding area, and I can't be open, do I still get the money, and what do I do with that?
My understanding is, yes, you still do. I mean, you have to apply for it, and it's going to keep you above ground until we can get open. And that's the plan, because what we're seeing is so many restaurants are closing. Just 100,000 additional restaurants nationwide in the past 2 weeks closed, and that's on top of the hundreds of thousands that have already closed over the past 6-7 months.
Right, but I think part of the complication the first time was that you needed to, though, apply so much of that money to payroll, and there was no payroll for businesses that could not open. So while it might be rent relief or other expenses that you had, maybe you'd keep it in the bank until you opened up again, but it was kind of complicated for these businesses because they couldn't open their doors.
True. Well, my understanding is, I mean, this will help them open the doors a little bit, possibly pay back rent, any other, you know, vendors or partners that they have been behind in paying. And it'll also give the operators a chance to just really stay alive, because if we lose them now, they're not going to come back.
What else is happening with your clients or in the businesses that you work with?
Well, we're seeing a lot of restaurant clients actually doing a lot of planning and openings. So what's happening is, because so many restaurants are closed right now, they're great deals. Some of these are no money up front rents that you can get in the door and sign, and you don't even pay rent until you open. So unfortunately, when one door closes, the good news is another door opens. So, you know, so many restaurants are closing, but there will be many new concepts. We're seeing everything from ghost kitchens and virtual brands, even existing companies that are, you know, full-service concepts that are creating different either fast casual or virtual brands. So, you know, the hospitality and restaurant industry is the third largest employer in America. It'll never go away. So although we're hitting many bumps in the road here, we're going to see many new great concepts come out of this, and we will prevail.
So I'm looking at a list of some of your clients: Lettuce Entertain You, Olive Garden, Capital Grill, Longhorn Steakhouse, etc. So these businesses are probably meeting now saying, okay, what does it look like when we come back? And are we ready for that? Do we need to have more outlets or fewer outlets? Do we need to change the interior? Decisions like that.
Absolutely. And a lot of them are still operating. But even now we're seeing where restaurant concepts are adding in drive-thrus, which is, you know, like Sweetgreen has announced they're going to start putting in drive-thrus, or Chipotle. So, you know, even the fast casual ones where people can walk in the door, restaurants are adapting, and they need to adapt. And so many of them, you mentioned the larger concepts like Let Us Entertain You, which is, you know, one of our best restaurant companies here in Chicago. They're creating new ideas and figuring out different ways through ghost kitchens, so on and so forth, to reach, and you know, as many customers as they can.
Is it also complicated, maybe even impossible, to know what it's going to be like? That is, you say, okay, we're going to have drive-through windows, limit the menu, and have better dishes to carry out in. And then come September, we don't need any of that, and everybody's eating indoors. And all the money and time you've invested in that fix was only for a handful of months.
You know, I think it's going to be both. I think the initial investment is going to be something that's not going to go away. People are still going to want to have DoorDash. People are still going to want to have curbside pickup. People are still going to want to have a quick meal. But when full-service dining is back, absolutely, everyone's going to want to go out, and they're still going to have that option to dine in, have that server take care of them, enjoy that great meal, have that celebration, and really enjoy getting out of the house. So I think both. You know, everything that's happening now, the ghost kitchen, some of the new branding, they're not going to go away. But once full-service comes back, people are going to be clamoring out to go and enjoy.
You posted five things every restaurant owner should focus on when hiring in a post-pandemic America. What are you talking about there?
Well, I think what's really important, so many people are leaving the hospitality industry. You look at bartenders and food servers, you know, they're not making the money they used to. A lot of managers are leaving because either when they were furloughed, they realized, wow, I have nights off, weekends off, I had the summer off, this is great. I'm going to get a Monday through Friday job. So I think what operators need to do is be real crafty as they're opening up and really look at different ways of attracting new talent. We've always looked at a lot of our culinary schools and hospitality schools, but there's a lot of other folks out there, a lot of other industries like retail that's been hit hard where we can go out and attract new talent. You know, just a lot of who, you know, referrals are so big right now. The few employees you do have, pay them well. Give them a referral bonus of $1,000, $3,000 that I'm seeing if they refer an employee who comes in and stays for 90 days or so with your company. So operators need to be creative because the talent pool is shifting. It is definitely smaller, and it's not going to get bigger as we start opening up restaurants again.
Yeah, I was wondering if the pay or tipping schedules might be different when we go back in.
You know, I don't think they will. Right now, I mean, the consumer loves to tip, and they're so happy to be able, and they're over-tipping, which is great. 15 to 20% is standard for good service. I don't think that's going to change. I think people want to get out. I think the career servers will come back, but not the ones that left the industry. It'll be new ones that are being developed and come in. A lot of my clients I see where they're taking possibly even service assistants and bar backs and turning them into bartenders and servers, giving them that next opportunity. I'm also seeing we're in the kitchen where somebody was a dishwasher. They stuck with them. You know, now they're a line cook. They're learning that opportunity, or the line cook is becoming a supervisor, or the supervisor is becoming a manager. So everyone's getting the chance to really step up if they're sticking with our industry, and that's great news.
How much anger are you hearing from your clients about the fact that they've had to close up again?
You know, not really anger. Everyone understands. I mean, there's some people that may or may not agree with the governor's decision here in Illinois to close restaurants at times, but I don't really see or hear any anger. I mean, there's frustration. Obviously, there's financial, but I don't really see any anger. Everyone understands. They're doing what they can to stay in business, to, you know, stay in the black, and to really continue to take care of their customers.
I bet they're anxious to get rid of those tents in front of their places. I mean, in a way, it was kind of cozy in the fall, but now those places just don't look that safe to me. They look like flimsier versions of the same problem you had in the brick-and-mortar store. And I know that must satisfy the letter of the law, but I'm not sure that those things are all that safe, you know?
Yeah, I would have to agree with you, especially those little bubbles. I mean, they're so enclosed.
Yeah.
And, you know, even if you have just a party of four in that little bubble and a server's coming in, even with the mask that everyone has on, there's still no guarantee that, you know, that COVID can't be transmitted. So, yeah, it's also expensive for the operators to do that. And now with the colder weather, it's very difficult to keep them comfortable and warm. And even the server coming in and out, it's what we have to do.
I was walking to the train the other day, and it was pretty cold and windy, and here was a guy walking out of the restaurant, down the sidewalk, into a bubble. And I just thought, this is a miserable way to serve food. It's a miserable way to eat food. I was glad people were doing it, but it's, I thought, this is not sustainable. This is not sustainable. I can't believe, in fact, I suspect they aren't making any profit doing it that way, but some of them have just stuck their neck out to, kept their neck out there just to stay in business.
You're absolutely right. I mean, they're really not making profit. They're trying to generate some income. They're still trying to take care of their customers. But the reality is no restaurant can make money on two or three or five bubbles.
Yeah.
Even if they have a large tent, it's still usually 50% or more or less than the regular indoor seating. And restaurants need to be full. You know, they need to be full, not just Fridays and Saturdays, but, you know, 3, 4, 5 days a week. So you're right. They're really not making money, but something's coming in the door. They're keeping people employed. They're keeping their customers happy. And that's what it's about.
Bruce Faber, the owner of EHS Hospitality, Illinois and Wisconsin branches, EHSHospitality.com. Thanks, Bruce.
Thank you so much, John. Have a great day.
Yeah, have a good holiday. About ready to turn the corner on 2020, Toodles 2020. I see 21 Chicago startups to watch in 2021. Let's talk a little bit about that with Catherine Davis, the associate editor at ChicagoInno.com. Hey, Catherine, interesting list. How are you today?
I'm good, John. How are you?
Good. So we're leaving 2020. You guys are looking forward in the city. Is there a category that jumps out at you, or is it a crowded space one way or another?
Yeah. So the interesting thing about our annual Startups to Watch list is that it's pretty diverse across industry and sector. You know, the idea with this list really is to introduce readers, business leaders, investors to 21 early stage startups that are poised to grow in the coming year. So we define that as raising funding rounds or hiring tens, hundreds of people, or coming out with new products. And so, you know, this year on the list, there's a lot of interesting companies, all from different backgrounds. You know, some work in the real estate tech sector. Others work in funeral planning tech, and others are working in sort of, you know, justice software for public defenders. So it really runs the gamut.
No kidding. Let me just throw a couple titles out at you. You give me a headline, and we'll skip through some of these. 86 repairs. If you run a restaurant, you got all kinds of repairs. You don't maybe want to take the time or invest the money in having somebody full-time do that, so this is a business that comes in and does that, huh?
Yeah, so think of this as an app for, like, on-demand people who can come and troubleshoot issues at your restaurant. So you can schedule the repair, track how much you're spending on equipment maintenance, and, you know, get everything done that you need to. The reason they're on this list is because they raised $1.5 million last year, and, you know, based on the sort of the traction and the customers they have now, they're poised for growth next year.
A cash drop is another interesting business to me in what would be described as a crowded space. Aren't there a lot of people doing what cash drop wants to do?
Yeah. Well, so the thing about cash drop, so they're making a mobile app that sort of changes the game for small business owners who want to set up an online shop and accept mobile orders. So as you can imagine, with COVID and people doing more online shopping, you know, even those smaller businesses, not the large retailers, right, have to figure out a way to sell things online. And this is essentially what Cash Drop is doing. And the really novel thing about them is that they do it in, you know, sort of the least expensive way possible and in the most simple way for, you know, the store owner that isn't necessarily tech savvy but needs to have this kind of edge for their business.
You all wrote about a business called Copilot. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so Copilot is a startup that wants to help you get a better deal on your next car. They're founded in 2018, and basically they're using some high-tech stuff like machine learning as well as human experts to help buyers find the best price on new and used vehicles. So, you know, as you can imagine, this is sort of a space that gets a lot of attention. There's always sort of this automobile tech. We've seen it with, you know, automobile insurance as well. But really getting people the best price for all things having to do with their car is a super popular business model.
I think you alluded to this one, Justice Text.
Yes. So Justice Text is a cool one. It was founded by University of Chicago alums. And essentially what they're doing is making software that uses speech-to-text machine learning algorithms that transcribe video footage. So, you know, if you're a public defender, you would use justice tech software when you're putting together your case to defend your client. This, you know, saves them a lot of time from having to watch every second of video footage. This way they can run through a transcription key or search keywords that they're looking for and do their work quicker, essentially. The really cool thing about Justice Tech is that they are backed by David Axelrod through his program, the Institute of Politics at UChicago.
What about LifeWeb 360?
Yeah, so LifeWeb 360, they were founded last year. And essentially, they're an online platform that allows you to create memory pages to honor someone who recently died. So I interviewed the founders earlier this year, and they told me that, you know, through the COVID pandemic, as many people have turned to virtual funeral or memorial services, they've seen an uptick in users, about 300% increase in usage. They were also a startup that received a grant from Google earlier this year. So definitely poised for growth, I'd say, next year.
How about RentGrata? Am I saying that right?
Yes, RentGrata. So, you know, they're pretty straightforward. They're an app that helps you find homes, but by connecting with current tenants. So essentially they operate a referral reward platform for apartment communities, and it's a way to find a home based on how the person that lives there currently, through their eyes, how they view it and how they like it. So it's really interesting, and they have raised some venture capital funding, and their investors told us that they have great traction and will be growing next year as well.
That's interesting because the renter doesn't care, right? They'll tell you the truth, whereas a home owner selling might not want to tell you all the dirty little secrets about the house or the neighborhood, but a renter's like, I'm leaving, and if you want to know, I'll tell you. But you don't normally have access to that person. This, I guess we would both need to be on the app then, huh?
Yeah, I think that's how it works.
What about Zing Health? Can you give me just a headline or two on Zing?
Yeah, so Zing is essentially a health insurance startup, and they're trying to provide health insurance to minority people 65 and over that are typically underserved by traditional models. It's founded by, you know, the founder of TWG Partners, which is a healthcare investment firm, and this is not his first company. He's founded several before.
So for minorities 65 and older that are typically underserved by traditional insurance models, I'm glad that's there, and I'm sad there's a need for that, but the market will find a way. Zing Health, and that's just some of them. 21 Chicago startups to watch in 2021. All right, very interesting. Catherine Davis, we can read more at chicagowinnow.com. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, John.
There they go. It's time for more business news. It's 12:42 on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Loretto Hospital in Chicago is one of the first hospitals in the country to receive Moderna's new coronavirus vaccine. The facility is among 4,000 across the country to get doses that shipped from the company on Sunday. Walgreens is targeting the week of December 28th to start giving COVID-19 vaccines at Illinois' long-term care facilities. The Deerfield-based pharmacy chain started administering vaccines last week at facilities in Ohio and Connecticut. Nearly half of Illinois' 15,000 COVID-19 deaths have happened in long-term care facilities. Chicago's supply chain technology provider Project 44 has secured $100 million in Series D funding. The company's tech allows companies to see how their shipments are moving through distribution networks and to make adjustments in case of snags or changes in market demands. The new funding will help Project 44 expand its reach. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Lots of ground to cover now with Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Then into the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom, WGN Radio News, before Anna DeVlanta Show, featuring one Matt Bubala. That'll be a good show. Listen for that as we listen for Amy Guth. Amy, let's start on the least important topic of all, shall we? Do you know what that is?
I'm guessing it has something to do with McDonald's.
I can't. So is this like something they're serving because they're mad at people or because they want people to come in?
I know. I had the same thought. I was like, is that supposed to be a good thing or a punishment? So
yeah.
McDonald's in China, they are selling a burger that is made topped with Spam, questionable already, and then crushed Oreo cookies. So I can't imagine that being delicious, but according to Google Translate, that's being described as fairy tale taste. So I don't know. I'm not sure about that. You know, we've seen a lot of fast food chains that do kind of wild gimmicky things to get people to try it and Instagram it and put something on social media about it. We saw like the charcoal black bun from Burger King a while back and some outrageous tacos from Taco Bell. I cannot think of quite anything of that caliber, Spam plus Oreos. But I mean, I have so many questions of like, what, who came up with that and who was like, yeah, that's a great idea. We're going to do that.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, cultures are different. So maybe for some reason, a Spam burger topped with Oreo cookies is appealing to people in China, but who knew? I mean, how did they decide that that's something they all wanted over there?
I know, of all the two things you could add to a burger, those are probably pretty low on my list of things that I would go, Oreos, yeah, let's do that, let's make
and
that work.
McDonald's is pretty brand conscious, that is, I'm a little surprised they would allow something that far-fetched to be served in their restaurants, you know?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And they, you know, they, it's been interesting to watch their earnings reports come in this year of how it really aligned really well with where stay-home orders were happening, where the virus was surging. But they thrived pretty well because they, you know, rely heavily on takeout and drive-through, and they made some improvements to speed up drive-through times and things like that. And it's really interesting to me, particularly around drive-through stuff, just how seconds can translate to millions of dollars. Like saving you seconds at the drive-through window, making it faster, ends up being really huge on their bottom line. So, you know, the McDonald's, the Chinese market in McDonald's, they had, you know, they didn't see quite as long of a stumble as we did here in the U.S. because things opened up a little earlier there.
Yeah.
But yeah, there you go. There's a burger that's available for a very limited time. It'll be interesting to see how people react to it. I think it'll be interesting to watch social media and see what people do with this. I mean, if you have that, you have to tweet a picture of it or post it on Instagram
something. Yeah, that's right. By the way, speaking of brands that are well-known and you think would never have to worry about anything, Coca-Cola is cutting jobs.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So they've said that they're going to be cutting quite a few jobs, about 2,200 jobs globally. They've said, you know, this isn't really exactly because of the pandemic. It's not really a cost-cutting, but that the pandemic sort of gave them some time and some catalysts, I guess, to really rethink how they do business and really, you know, rejigger the whole, the whole company organization. So they're doing away with some brands that weren't selling too well that are underneath the Coca-Cola banner, like Odwalla juices and Zyko coconut water and things like that. And a couple of really specialty things like a feisty cherry Diet Coke, which maybe that goes with our Spam and Oreo burger or something.
Mm-hmm.
So they're trimming down and they're just really kind of trying to focus. We've seen this from a lot of food and beverage brands this year. Kraft Heinz has kind of made some inroads in that same direction, not with the job cuts per se, but really streamlining operations and saying, okay, what are the things people really lean on? Let's invest there and make sure the supply chain is really strong and unbreakable. And the things that aren't selling as well, is it worth it to do that anymore? So I think that, you know, Coke is just kind of the latest to be thinking about that. But again, there's a global company that's starting to make these kind of trims. Its U.S. headcount at the end of 2019, so kind of right before the pandemic hit, was about 10,400 people. So even, you know, 2,200 people, that's still a pretty good chunk. It's not quite what we saw from airlines, but still a pretty good chunk of people as we see them kind of rolling out this new organizational plan.
We've all been talking about Walgreens, or CVS for that matter. How are the drugstore retail points going to begin to administer the vaccines? But what jumps out at you as you're reading about this?
Yeah, you know, what I think is really interesting, watching Deerfield-based Walgreens talk about their rollout plan, and they're really, I think, doing a pretty good job of talking about what's ahead. You know, they're saying, okay, this week, starting this week, they've been looking at long-term care facilities in other markets. Starting the week of December 28th, they're going to start giving the COVID-19 vaccines at long-term care facilities here in Illinois, but they're also using language like, once this is more widely available, once this will be available to the general public, we're prepared to vaccinate, you know, a lot. They're really, really leaning on, hey, this is something that's going to be available at just about all of our pharmacy locations. you know, in the same way that we see signs for, you know, get your flu shot, things like that. They're really thinking a lot about how they can roll that campaign out. Of course, CVS and Walgreens are specifically working with the government to get that campaign out. I mean, that's a very ambitious vaccine campaign that we've never seen the likes of before. So these two, with their infrastructure being what it is, because they have so many locations and so much shipping infrastructure and so much, you know, logistics and things like that on their side, the government has leaned on them to really help get the vaccine first to the most vulnerable in each state, and then moving into prioritized groups and eventually the general public if they would like one.
Now, they tell us there'll be no cost to you and me, and really they're the victims of supply, right? I mean, they can't give it to us
Absolutely.
Unless they get it first, and we just don't have it it's not ready for stores yet. Both of them told me earlier, Amy, I guess this won't surprise you, that they think early spring, whatever that means, but that's earlier than July, so that's good.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we're going to see a lot of, local officials have been talking about campaigns to really target people that might be reluctant to get a vaccine, and people that might get that first dose and go, well, I don't feel good. I feel like I have the flu. Maybe, you know, I don't know if I want that second dose, of kind of measuring expectations and setting expectations of what happens after you get the first dose, how you feel, what you need to plan for, how that goes, to make sure people get that second dose. So I think we're going to start seeing locally and nationally a lot of messaging around what that experience is like and, you know, what setting expectations for this vaccine rollout.
Amy Guth, following all of that on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.